listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Change Agent by Marie Brenner, with photographs by Frankie Alduino. Insurrection Day would become for Slotkin the ultimate test of character. The violence of January 6th was a turning point. Before that, I would have said, look, there's two types of Republicans I work with. The true believers, who really feel strongly and deeply that they love Donald Trump and believe and support a lot of what he says. Then there's the other category, and they know better, and they don't like him. Sometimes they dislike him as much as we do. January 6th, you barricade yourself in your office and look for a weapon, and it gives you some clarity. That, to me, was like, if you don't say anything and you vote with him, you are actually maybe worse because you are covering. A while later, she said, she was on a call with a Republican congressman I know and I like, who had voted against certification of Biden's victory that night. He said, Alyssa, you don't understand. People in my district are furious. They are forming militias. They are threatening my staff, my family. So I had to vote against certification. And I said, Congressman, do you know what we call that in my district? Wednesday. What do you think those of us in rural America are getting every day? I get threatened all the time. We have militias. I mean, Michigan. People literally took over the Capitol 9 months before January 6th. Her Republican friend was saying, as she saw it, I'm too scared to stand up to it. It was just such a sad moment. Fast forward to mid-February 2025. One by one, members of the GOP caucus would fall in line with the president's decrees and nominees. Government officials were being dismissed en masse. Federal prosecutors were resigning rather than carry out constitutionally dubious orders. Agencies were being taken over by those who'd been advocating against their very existence. Slotkin, however, always takes the long view. Soon after, a veteran Republican senator came to reassure her that, given time, they could get some national security legislation done together. He said, let's talk again in March, because we have got to get all our craziness out. My colleagues do not realize we are about to own everything, so there's going to be a lot of executive orders, and then we will get back to a more even footing. In our first conversation, I asked how she planned to function in the months to come, especially in a paralyzed Democratic Party. What do you know about game theory? Slotkin responded, taking out a legal pad. She drew a grid with four large squares. On the left side, she wrote tactical and strategic. That means, is it short-term, tactical, or is it long-term, strategic? On the right side, she wrote reversible, and underneath that, irreversible. She then pointed to the box marked strategic and irreversible. She looked at me and said, strategic and irreversible is the box I am going to work in. I am not going to react to the five crazy things the president will say or do every day. And who or what, I ask, would come first in her strategic and irreversible grid? Pete Hegseth, she said, without hesitation. I have staffed the departments at the Pentagon for four defense secretaries and seen them up close. I have traveled with them and been with them in the Situation Room. With Trump's then nominee for Pentagon chief, she went on, there is the entire history of his sexual impropriety, drinking, all that stuff. I don't approve, but it's tactical. The tactical is not her worry. My concern is what he's going to do on the job based on what he has already said. Trump has said that he might use the uniformed military inside the United States in a way that contradicts the Constitution. You start using the military as your own personal militia force. You politicize the military. That is a genie that cannot be put back in the bottle. That is strategic and irreversible. Of all the issues I have with Pete Hegseth, that's the one I want to go deep on. It was mid-January when Slotkin found a day to take a break and return to Holly. She invited me to the farm for some downtime before heading to Detroit to catch the Lions NFC title game. When I arrived, ice covered the driveway. A barn was emblazoned with a sign for high-grade meats. In a fenced area nearby, Slotkin's mixed-breed hounds started howling. It was a balmy 30 degrees. On icier Michigan days, Slotkin loves to tell visitors to buckle up, Buttercup, then throw them into her open Jeep. She greeted me in jeans and ushered me past the cluttered mudroom into her kitchen. I had no time to clean up, she said, smiling. This is how it is. She had already zipped into town to pick up croissants. The setting was rustic. Furniture from Costco in the den, walls of family photos, the dining room with her grandmother's walnut brake front. It was here as a child that Slotkin began to get by on her own out of necessity. She was left alone for hours, she told me, to roam the farm, which became her laboratory for self-reliance. I was curious how the loss of the family business, which she rarely speaks about, might have impacted her early childhood. On the surface, the facts of Slotkin's life suggest the wealth and privilege of a meat heiress, but the Slotkins were long out of the company by the time it eventually sold to Sara Lee for $140 million. Slotkin's father, Kurt, went out on his own and would become a meat broker, starting his day at 5 a.m. and touring grocery chains. We had real money problems when my father moved us here when I was 4, Slotkin said. I am one of the senators with the least amount of money. Look it up. I did. She ranks 79 out of 100. Their financial status was secondary to a larger concern. Slotkin's mother, Judy, a travel agent who was a vibrant, voluble Detroit native, was diagnosed with severe metastasized breast cancer not long after giving birth to her son, Keith, Slotkin's brother. While Judy remained in New York for months undergoing experimental treatment, Kurt took the toddlers to Holly. We moved so my father could work in the meat industry, the senator remembered, and from the age of 5, she reveled in the joy of being so free, doing everything on my own, with the farmhands, somewhat aware of where I was. An electric fence protected the cows that still grazed the land. One day she asked her dad, "Is the fence off? I want to play outside." "Yes," he said. "I got the shock of my life," she recalled. "I ran into the house and screamed my head off." It was an early lesson in how to rely on her own instincts. It was the first time I stood up to him. Slotkin is close with her father, a strict disciplinarian and Reagan Republican who was passionate about wanting his children to understand current events. Family dinners, Keith told me, were eaten in silence during Tom Brokaw's nightly news. And when it was over, we all discussed. And we were awakened in the morning with my dad's announcing who had won the last night's football and basketball games. Her mother, on the mend, had rejoined the family. Slotkin, the first girl in 2 generations of many cousins, was doted on by her grandmother and Judy. She wanted me to be a Broadway star, she told me. My middle name is Blair. She knew Slotkin would never work on the stage, but Blair? She stuck me in dance classes, permed my hair. I was a total tomboy, and that drove her insane. When Slotkin was 9, her parents divorced, though she and Keith were not told why until much later. My mother came out, But this being Detroit in the 80s, it was more or less a secret. Children often learn to compartmentalize the complexities that lurk under family silence. Many of my father's closest friends were homophobic, Slotkin said. These were people I knew and loved. Judy moved into a condo in Bloomfield Hills, decorated in Art Deco style by a beloved friend whose partner wound up getting AIDS. Their apartment became a kind of social center for the Detroit gay world, such as it was, Slotkin said, relating how her mother took care of dying friends. Slotkin began to realize that Judy had never been careful with money. She needed her daughter in many ways to become the adult in charge. Even so, Slotkin told me, no one in the family talked about my mother's sexuality. My mom was flamboyant. Slotkin would pick up traits from her persona. Hello, it was very Nathan Lane. I loved it. I think this is why I am such an extrovert. I got that from my mom. And I think the seriousness from the Slotkin side. Perhaps the family turbulence and her early independence set her on a course to excel. She became class president 4 years in a row and a star athlete. I wouldn't be here, she said, without the leadership training that I got in women's sports. Even though her father, citing the expense, resisted his ex-wife's insistence that Slotkin attend the elite Cranbrook School in Bloomfield Hills, Judy managed to get family funds to cover the cost. Then, at 16, Slotkin was a counselor on a wilderness hiking trip in the Smoky Mountains when 94 Cranbrook students were trapped in a freak blizzard, becoming disoriented. Some were trapped for days. Slotkin, assigned to one group, was able to rig tarps and help get her charges down the mountain to a base camp, which quickly filled with National Guard members who worked with her and the school librarian to rescue others. One teacher lost his hands and feet. As the first hikers were found and rescued, they congregated at a motel playing video games. I stayed in the war room with the adults, Slotkin said. To be engaging with the U.S. military for the first time in my life, seeing the media swarm the motel, and being in the crew telling the authorities, we think the helicopter run should be in that section of the mountain. Looking back, I know that was formative. At Cornell, Slotkin focused on global development, mastered Swahili, and went to Kenya to do relief work. She landed a job in an Arab village in Israel. The day she arrived, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, she recalled, went to Jerusalem's Temple Mount, and the bombs started falling for the second Intifada. They closed off access to the village, and I was in Haifa working with Palestinians, with no money, sharing a bedroom with an Irishman with a curtain divider. There were suicide bombers hitting the bus stops and the beach. It was my first time war experience. Not long after, she took off for Cairo to master Arabic. Slotkin would return to the States, moving to New York to register for an international master's program at Columbia. 2 days later came 9/11. I knew immediately from the first report of a plane hitting the World Trade Center, this was terrorism. By the end of the day, I knew that fighting terrorists was my future. 4 months after graduation, having been recruited by the CIA, she was at Langley, joining a few dozen newly hired analysts who worked out of a trailer with green Mylar on the window. Soon she would be on the way to Baghdad, where she filed terrorist evaluations for the president's morning briefing books while working in Saddam Hussein's former palace, which U.S. forces had turned into a command center and temporary embassy. I was the lowest-level briefer, she told me, but not long after I arrived, my boss slipped on the marble floor and had to be airlifted back to the States. Suddenly, at 27, Slotkin was briefing the CIA station chief and the new ambassador, John Negroponte. A few months later, Negroponte told her, as she recounted, the president wants a new cabinet post. They are naming me the first national director of intelligence. You can be my assistant, and we leave Monday. We were a team of five, and we set up every aspect of the agency, the staffing, and the seal. So you can only imagine how I feel about the appointment of Tulsi Gabbard to be Trump's Director of National Security. DNI, I am not sure what her path is. When she was a Democrat, she was on the House Armed Services Committee with me, and she didn't really show up a lot. Slotkin's public-facing attitude about Gabbard has been no less forgiving. On the Senate floor, she dispensed with the limp euphemisms favored by her Republican colleagues to scorch the calumny of the notion that Gabbard would even be considered for DNI. Gabbard, Slotkin said, has shown a repeated preference for our adversaries, most notably a surprise trip to visit the now ousted president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. Imagine the decision-making that goes into planning a secret trip to visit a man who has killed thousands of his countrymen, thousands of relatives of Michiganders that I represent, to go and visit this man, throw flowers at his feet. The same goes for her seeming glorification of Vladimir Putin. It is an insult to people who have dedicated their lives and put themselves in harm's way to have her confirmed into this position. At the farm, a large walnut desk in the living room's bay window has pride of place. The desk, which belonged to Slotkin's great-grandfather, Sam, Highgrade's founder, had been owned by Lindley Garrison, Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of War. Sam, the senator said, had donated to Wilson's campaign, and someone gave it to him. He worked at it every day of his life. It was at this desk, she told me, that she'd perused the Federalist Papers before deciding to join her colleagues to vote to impeach Trump. I wasn't sure that the constitutional mandate reached that far, she said, but her readings helped persuade her that the president had violated his oath. It was here as well that she was watching TV, only to see her congressman, Mike Bishop, smirking into the camera, as she put it, saying that he had cast his vote against Obamacare. Trump was already in the White House, but Bishop's seat was coming up. That was it, she said. I was so angry. I made the decision to run. No one was going to stop me. Her motivation was personal. For years, she'd watched her mother struggle with breast and ovarian cancer. In Washington in 2009, while dating her future husband, Dave Moore, a former helicopter pilot she had met in Iraq, Slotkin discovered that Judy, in desperate financial straits, had not renewed her medical insurance. As a result, the couple, along with Keith, who by then was working as a research geneticist, would cover their mother's bills. She went 5 years without medical insurance, without telling us. It was pre-Obamacare, where it was perfectly legal to gouge someone with a pre-existing condition. I learned to be outraged. It was horrible. I mean, it's a blur now. I was doing all the paperwork for her to declare bankruptcy. Judy's picture in the hospital appeared in her daughter's first campaign ads and in those for last year's Senate run. Everywhere I go in Michigan, people think they knew my mother, Keith told me. Slotkin sped up her wedding plans so that Judy could attend. She died 6 months later. While Slotkin and Moore, 14 years her senior, stayed together through her first years in Congress, their marriage could not take the strain of the demands of her life in politics. She told me her relationship with her ex-husband was congenial. That's all I have to say. At one point, I inquired if there was anything important I hadn't raised with her. She replied, "You haven't asked me why I am a Democrat." "So why?" I asked. Again, Slotkin went back to her mother, whom she described as a gay man trapped in a gay woman's body. The way I watched her taking care of her gay friends who got AIDS. At the time, Ronald Reagan was president, and he wouldn't talk about the disease. I swore then that I would never have anything to do with a party that had that kind of cruelty. The thing I pride myself on the most is that I am independently minded. I'm hard to put in a box, but on social issues, I don't try to tell other people how to live. I don't always agree with my party on fiscal issues, national security issues, but on who gets to be in the club, I have a pretty expansive view of who gets to see themselves as equal citizens, and I never liked the bullying that went on in certain Republican circles. It really bothers me. After Trump put Hegseth forward to be his defense secretary, Slotkin had meetings at the Pentagon and was alarmed. Many considered him unqualified and opposed his nomination. In mid-January, she made her public debut as a United States senator and from her post on the Armed Services Committee began grilling Hegseth. Only months into her opening remarks, she pushed out the term posse comitatus, a clear reference to the potential use of American troops in a law enforcement capacity at the southern border. Slotkin's gifts as a speaker include her flawless manners. She rarely condescends, though she can throw out some zingers. She never comes across as didactic, even when she reminded Hegseth that the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act was meant to underscore that our founders designed the system so that we weren't going to use active duty military inside the United States and make Americans scared of their own military. "Do you believe that there is such a thing as an illegal order?" she continued. "Is there anything a commander-in-chief could ask you to do with the uniformed military that would be in violation of the U.S. Constitution?" Her intentions were obvious. Hegseth stared at her and said, "I reject the premise that..." "You've done your genuflecting to him," she shot back, then reminded him that one of his predecessors, Mark Esper, had to issue an apology for using the military to clear peaceful protesters near the White House at Trump's command. "Was he right or wrong to apologize?" she asked. Hegseth punted. "What are you scared of?" she asked him. "Did he do the right or wrong thing by apologizing?" Back and forth they went. "You said that JAG officers are potentially people who put their own interest in their own medals and promotions ahead of the troops." Senator Lindsey Graham was a JAG officer for most of his life. "Is that what you believe about those who implement our justice system in the U.S. military?" The entire exchange would light up social media and be replayed on multiple news shows. "I could book her all day long if she would allow it," her then-senior advisor Gordon Trowbridge told me. Slotkin had arrived, but so had Hegseth. He got through the Senate by a tie vote, broken by Vance. The next day, Slotkin took her seat on the Homeland Security Committee, surrounded by briefing books, waiting to square off against Russell Voigt. Selected to lead the Office of Management and Budget, Voigt had written chunks of the right-wing playbook Project 2025, which called for a kind of sweeping presidential authority not attempted since the Nixon years. Voigt, the insider's insider, who had led OMB during Trump's first term, said repeatedly that in his new position, he would have a mandate to override congressional acts with which he disagreed. "Before the hearings began," Slotkin had told me, "Mr. Voigt literally believes in impoundment. He believes that even if the Congress, a Republican Congress, appropriates money for an issue, that he has the right, through Donald Trump, to decide whether we actually spend the money." At the hearing, Slotkin was no less assertive. "My concern with you and with potential Secretary Hegseth," she remarked, "is that when asked clear constitutional questions about the allocation of money, you can't answer a straight constitutional question. Can you confirm for me, please, that you will abide by the Constitution and current law as it is, not what you wish it to be?" Voigt lobbed back an answer that included the term extensive policy process, an exasperated Slotkin said, "You can see how this is a bureaucratic, wonky answer you keep giving, right? You're claiming to be an outsider that says you're going to shake things up. I just want to hear that when you hold up your hand, you are going to protect and defend the Constitution. And that's what bothers me about you." Slotkin burrowed down on Voight's record of seeking to cancel a long-fought bipartisan effort to maintain and clean the Great Lakes, which comprise 20% of the fresh water in the world. "Can you confirm you submitted a zeroing out of that program 3 years in a row the last time you were OMB director?" "It's been a long time, Senator. I would have to go back and refresh my memory," he said, staring back at her. The high drama would come on February 5th, the night before the floor vote on Voight's confirmation. In a theatrical move, Schumer, the leading Senate Democrat, scheduled an all-nighter, a made-for-TV Democratic talk-a-thon, in an attempt to stall the ascension of the man many considered to be the most radical of Trump's cabinet appointments. The minority leader's gambit turned out to be a futile attempt to push back the inevitable. It also had an unfortunate repercussion. Slotkin and others in her freshman class, who had been scheduled to give their traditional coming-out speeches to the full Senate, would now have to do so to an empty chamber well past midnight. The political theater accomplished little. Vote would be confirmed the next day. But Slotkin, nonetheless, would have her moment. At 6 a.m., she walked to the podium and in a bright red blazer and matching blouse spoke to a hall of ghosts. "What has disturbed me the most in my first month here," she said, "is the willingness of the people in this city and in this body to roll over as the Constitution, our most sacred document, is pushed aside. To me, the only thing that matters is that any administration uphold the Constitution. Because if not, what are we? What are we doing here?" It would become a theme. "If you're not going to exercise your authority," she said, "to block nominees you believe to be unworthy of cabinet positions, to assert legislative roles typically denied the executive branch, to exercise the constitutionally sanctioned power of the purse, then what is the point of being an elected person?" On and on it went, this quadrennial ritual. That week, Slotkin also questioned Kristi Noem, whose nomination for Homeland Security Chief the senator finally signed off on. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, Slotkin, who'd spent her career in intelligence, worked vigorously to oppose Gabbard for D&I. There again was Slotkin on the Senate floor after midnight, slamming Gabbard for her baffling pronouncements on Russia and her 2017 meeting with Syria's Assad. Said the senator, "More egregious than anything, she has shown a repeated preference for our adversaries over the intelligence community in the United States of America." None of it would matter. All were confirmed. All would join the government payroll. And the job slashing, the norm busting, and the constitutionally questionable maneuvers would commence in earnest. One of Hegseth's first actions, for instance, as the new Secretary of Defense, was to send U.S. troops to the southern border. Then, on February 7th, Slotkin received an alert. That day, the news broke that the president had fired the director of the National Archives, Colleen Shogan, the woman who 3 months before had welcomed Slotkin to explore some of the nation's Rosetta Stones. The reasons behind the dismissal were all too clear. Even though she had not been at the helm in 2021 or 2022, when representatives from the archive, in the interest of national security, had requested that Trump return classified documents he had kept at Mar-a-Lago, Shogun would take the fall. Slotkin is well aware that she has been elected to the Senate at a moment when every facet of her skill set will be brought to bear on maintaining America's 249-year-old experiment in democracy. In January, she had two separate encounters at the Capitol that reminded her of the bigger picture, the need to move forward, and the unanticipated curves of chance and destiny. At one point, she unexpectedly ran into Elise Stefanik, and in the spirit of new beginnings, the two shook hands, congratulating each other warmly on their recent committee appointments. The second meeting was even more telling. En route to her Senate confirmation, Slotkin was riding the Capitol subway, which transports legislators between the Capitol and congressional office buildings. She carried a book-bound facsimile of the Torah, the five books of Moses, which had been signed by rabbis from across the state of Michigan. Suddenly, a young Capitol police officer boarded the car. She looked up and saw his name tag, Slotkin. "Slotkin," she said, "that's my name." "I know, Senator," he replied. As they rode along, they began to exchange family stories and quickly discovered that their great-grandfathers had been brothers. Upon arriving at the ceremony, she joined her father, Kurt, now in and out of a wheelchair. When she told him about the encounter, he wept. A while later, the senator posted a picture of her and the officer on Instagram with the caption, "Sometimes amazing coincidences happen that are hard to fathom. And sometimes history summons those who've come to serve." Flight Risk by Jeff Wise, with illustrations by Emiliano Ponzi. It's suspected that a recent spate of global aviation incidents involving exploding cargo, hacked GPS systems, or spoofed coordinates traces back to Russian aggressors. The sophistication of the attacks only rivals Russia's penchant for brutality. So what's next? The sky's the limit. Opening illustration shows a jet flying just beyond the grasp of a huge hand in the sky. First, smoke curled out from the cube of packages stacked on a pallet at a DHL logistics hub near Birmingham, England, last July. Then a lick of flame emerged from the top of the stack. Racing to prevent the fire from spreading, a forklift operator snatched up the burning pallet and dashed away with it, setting it down at a safe remove before the stack turned into a roaring bonfire. Not long after, 600 miles to the east, inside another DHL logistics hub in Leipzig, Germany, a similar scene played out. Then, according to Polish media, a third courier-related fire started near Warsaw. Polish officials say they intercepted yet another device before it went off and arrested at least four suspects. Another suspect was arrested in Lithuania, according to the Wall Street Journal, and charged with sending four of the devices from the capital city of Vilnius. An incendiary device made of a magnesium-based substance had apparently sparked each fire. Investigators suspect that the sabotage was organized by Russia's military intelligence agency as part of an ongoing campaign to sow chaos across Western Europe. The packages that erupted in Germany and England were both scheduled to be shipped on planes operated by DHL, the global logistics company headquartered in Germany. One had arrived at the warehouse via air freight, and one was about to be loaded. Magnesium fires are particularly dangerous because dousing them with water only makes the fire worse. A special powder has to be used. The fire that ignited in Poland took 2 hours to extinguish, per local reports. If any of the packages had ignited in the cargo hold of a plane in flight, there would have been no easy way to prevent it from leading to one of the most feared and deadly in-flight disasters, a runaway fire that consumes oxygen and fills the air with poisonous smoke and fumes far too quickly for the pilots to get the plane on the ground. It would have resulted in a crash. Thomas Haldenwang, the former head of Germany's domestic intelligence department, told German parliament, "People could have been killed on the ground, and many more could have died if the devices had gone off on a passenger flight." But the DHL attacks, scary as they are not the end. They are among a number of recent events that threaten to upend air safety. Civil aviation around the world is now under sustained attack, both on the ground and in the air. The ongoing aggressions encompass sabotage and hijacking, as well as more modern kinds of strikes, such as breaching databases, tampering with navigational systems, and potentially even the hacking of onboard systems. While the aviation industry is aware of the danger, there has been no organized effort that has kept pace with the rate of cybersecurity attacks. Krishna Sampakadeya, chair and professor at the Cyber Intelligence and Security Department at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, a leading American aviation institution, says some steps have been taken, but it's an open and attractive space for attackers to target. Next illustration. Intelligence assessments of the DHL site near Birmingham, England, suggest the blast from a magnesium-based device could be strong enough to bring down a cargo plane. For decades, air travel has been the safest way to get around. year after year, aircraft engineers, airlines, and regulators have relentlessly honed the procedures for making, maintaining, and operating aircraft in order to narrow the margin for bad events. Rules are written in blood, the saying goes. The aviation industry fetishizes the following of procedures so that parts don't break and crews don't make dangerous mistakes. This is the core tenet of safety, eliminating opportunities for accidents. Safety is only part of the equation, though. The other part is security, defending against deliberate action. The first known case of an airplane hijacking was in 1931, when revolutionaries attempted to seize a Ford trimotor plane in Peru. By the late 60s, hijackings had become a weekly occurrence throughout the world, prompting officials to introduce the first anti-hijacking security measures, such as metal detectors and X-ray machines. Then came 9/11, which ushered in the era of sock footage shuffling through 3D scanners. TSA checkpoints and other security measures have appeared to be successful at warding off attackers with bombs and box cutters. But another class of potential perpetrator, or threat actor in security speak, is capable of advanced measures that are far more difficult to detect. Nation-state threat actors can tap the resources, talent, and funding of an entire country to plan and carry out malicious acts, and they don't even need to be in the airplane or at the airport. Historically, nations have largely avoided attacking one another in the air, save for a few conflicts that have occurred at moments of perilously high political tension. The international order has treated air travel as sacrosanct, a parallel realm in which aircraft of all nations are allowed to pass unmolested. The International Civil Aviation Organization, the United Nations agency that governs aviation, provides guidelines for countries to charge airlines for using their airspace. And these so-called overflight fees can be one of the rare sources of foreign revenue for rogue nations like Myanmar and North Korea. According to the Chicago Convention of 1944, which laid the underpinnings for international aviation law, signatory nations must refrain from resorting to the use of weapons against civil aircraft in flight, and the lives of persons on board and the safety of aircraft must not be endangered. To intentionally shoot down, blow up, or otherwise endanger an adversary's passenger vessel would be an overt act of war, on par with the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915. But the world has been changing, and so have the rules that adversaries play by. The strange disruptions began building in late 2023, striking airliners mid-flight over Ukraine and the Middle East. The anomalies spread to the Black Sea and the Baltic region, then to the Korean Peninsula, first a few here and there, then dozens, then hundreds. In the midnight dark of a red-eye cockpit, or during the afternoon tedium of a Europe to Asia lag, clocks can suddenly blip several minutes into the future or past. Map displays can shift dozens of miles off course, and altitude readings can go haywire. I was at 35,000 feet, and suddenly it said 1,000 feet, recalls Akseli Miskinen, a Finnair captain and president of the Finnish Pilots Association. Some planes descending to land have become so disoriented that they've had to abort their approach. By late April, the problem had gotten so bad in Estonia that Finnair canceled all its flights to Tartu, the country's second largest city. The disruptions appear to have emerged largely as a side effect of military activity related to drones. In recent years, weaponized drones have played an increasingly important role in conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine. They are small, cheap, plentiful, and hard to detect. Electronic warfare is one of the few effective ways to deter them. One form of electronic defense, called jamming, swamps the airwaves with noise so that GPS receivers can't hear the satellites. Another, spoofing, creates fake signals that mimic messages from GPS satellites, misleading GPS receivers about their location. Though specifically intended to confuse drones, these electronic countermeasures can wind up impacting huge swaths of sky. Once pilots are trained to recognize such attacks, they can respond. Flight crews are advised to switch off GPS receivers and use other forms of navigation. But a third method of attack, called smart spoofing, is more nefarious and can actually manipulate a specific aircraft's computer systems. Todd Humphreys, a professor of engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, was among the first to demonstrate the technique back in 2012. As he was studying the GPS protocol, Humphreys realized that a clever threat actor could almost undetectably disrupt a GPS-enabled navigation system. If you know the exact location of your target, you can send a signal that effectively lies to that target's GPS receiver about its own position. Not by very much, but just enough to convince the navigation system that it needs to correct its course. A patient attacker could keep adding slightly erroneous signals until the target is heading in a completely wrong direction. To test the idea, Humphreys laid out cables, laptops, and antennas on the floor of his home and patched together a prototype GPS spoofer. Humphreys then set his rig to spoof his own iPhone. As he watched, the blue dot on the navigation app screen started wandering across his neighborhood, even as the phone sat perfectly still. Shortly after, Humphreys perfected his spoofing rig and miniaturized it to fit in a portable box. During a 2013 demonstration in the Mediterranean Sea, Humphreys and his colleagues were able to take over the navigation system of an $80 million superyacht and send it off course. This kind of GPS attack is akin to hacking, since it uses knowledge of an adversary's control system to take it over. Because the ship's or plane's inertial navigation system doesn't realize that it's receiving corrupted information, it's virtually impossible for the system itself to recognize that something is going wrong. Current aircraft navigation systems can't detect it, says Xavier Orr, co-founder of Advanced Navigation, which builds navigation systems that are resistant to interference. If they don't know about it, they can't solve for it. Indeed, this is just what has been happening over the Baltic Sea, where the westernmost territories of Russia intercalate with Finland, Sweden, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. We have had many, many incidents where aircraft unintentionally flew into airspaces that they weren't supposed to, says Otjen de Bruijn, president of the European Cockpit Association. A similar hack was apparently used by Iran to steal one of America's top secret unmanned aircraft. In December 2011, an RQ-170 Sentinel was circling high above northeastern Iran, conducting surveillance, when its handlers suddenly lost control under circumstances that remain unclear. The Sentinel descended and was captured, mostly intact, by Iran. At first, the U.S. claimed the drone had malfunctioned. But eventually, it was reported that the Sentinel had likely fallen victim to Iranian electronic warfare forces, who had first jammed the drone's links to its operators and then spoofed GPS signals to lure it in for capture. According to U.S. aerospace reporter Stephen Trimble, the Iranians had recently received from Russia a sophisticated piece of electronic intelligence equipment called the Aftabaza, which is designed for radar signal interception and jamming. According to Finnish officials, There were more than 1,000 reports of GPS interference in 2024. There was little doubt to those officials as to who was causing the problem. Many disruptive signals had been traced back to the heavily defended Russian exclave of Kaliningrad, according to reports. But why would Russia wage electronic warfare against civilian aircraft in an area hundreds of miles from the nearest conflict? The answer has to do with Vladimir Putin's strategic goals. Since he came to power in 1999, Putin has been trying to revive Russian greatness as it was under the Tsars and the Soviets. This means dominating and annexing its neighbors. Putin has repeatedly questioned the sovereignty of Ukraine and Georgia, suggesting they are breakaway republics rather than fully independent nations. Finland and Estonia also fear his imperial goal of absorbing the Baltic region. Reviving Russian greatness is a project of immense importance for Putin, but it won't be an easy one to accomplish. Russia is poorer, smaller, and weaker than its adversaries in the democratic West, so Putin dares not pursue his ambitions too overtly. Instead, since at least 2013, Russia has waged a wide-ranging shadow war with a grab bag of offensive techniques, from hacking and misinformation to sabotage and assassination, keeping its enemies off balance while remaining in a gray zone in which the provenance of such attacks is unclear or the level of aggression is insufficient to trigger a hot war. For more than two decades, the Russian government has used its cyber capabilities to destabilize its neighbors and interfere in the domestic politics of democracies around the world, the Biden administration noted in its 2023 National Cybersecurity Strategy, adding that Russia remains a persistent cyber threat as it refines its cyber espionage, attack, influence, and disinformation capabilities. In this new mode of warfare, the sky is no longer a sanctuary. Over the last decade, the Kremlin and its allies have repeatedly targeted civilian aircraft. In 2014, a Russian Army air defense unit in Ukraine shot down a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet, killing all 298 aboard. In 2021, Belarus forced down an international flight over its territory to arrest a dissident aboard it. And in 2023, a plane carrying Yevgeny Prigozhin, leader of the Wagner Group, ignited midair and crashed under mysterious circumstances, just months after his mutiny against the Russian military leadership, though Russia has denied responsibility. Each act was a crime, but also a flex, demonstrating the ruthlessness and determination of the Russian state and the price that could be paid by those who defy it. In this context, the wave of GPS spoofing and jamming that has plagued the Baltics is being interpreted by many within the region as a threat and a punishment, specifically a response to Finland and Sweden's recent accession to NATO. Their decision to join was itself made in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which was made in response to Ukraine's attempt to peel itself away from Russian hegemony during the Maidan uprising of 2014. It is the latest escalation, in other words, in a long, enduring spiral. One of the objectives of hybrid warfare is to keep an opponent unsure of what is happening or why. Were the DHL attacks an earnest attempt to destroy a cargo plane? A test run to lay the groundwork for a later attack? Or perhaps a feint, a distraction from other, more dangerous schemes? There was no way to tell from the physical evidence alone. Unpredictability is the mark of a skilled gray zone operator, and a wide range of tools and styles is an asset. A feature of Russia's alleged campaign of disruption is that it uses different kinds of attacks. Some, like blasting an airliner out of the sky with a missile, are blunt, and brutal. Others can be dazzlingly brilliant. Russia's SolarWinds cyber attack, which bore deep into network management software between 2019 and 2020, involved techniques so ingenious that they had previously been deemed impossible. Investigators, Wired later reported, were blown away by the hack's complexity and extreme premeditation. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.